On this episode of Baseball Barbecast, we are joined by Dodgers catcher Dalton Rushing, special guest. We'll also talk about the fight that happened. That was something, huh? Lock in. Don't throw punches. Use your words. We certainly will. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbecast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks Jorge Soler should have just used his words. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And being honest about our feelings can save everybody a whole lot of trouble.
It does seem like he started to use his words, and then Jorge Soler made a very different decision. And that, friends, is our opener.
Fight night in Orange County. We got not a brawl, a heavyweight showdown. I believe both Reynaldo Lopez and Jorge Soler would be in said weight class between those two gentlemen in one of the more frisky physical confrontations that we have seen in a ball field in some time. This was not your typical macho hubris off when two players just chest up and yell. There was malice. There was real intent behind what happened in Anaheim on Tuesday night. Jordan, I will be honest with you. I was at Rogers Center in Toronto writing off that game when someone said, "Oh my God, oh my God," showed me the clip. I've spent relatively little time digging into this. You were sitting in the chair at your desk that you're sitting in now, probably when you found out about this. Can you hold my hand and just like give me the spark notes of this?
Thank you for being honest and revealing that you were covering Dodgers Blue Jays. That's very, very...
You're welcome.
It's very, I'm a big man. Real of you.
It takes a big man.
I know it took a lot to
If it makes you feel any better, that. It was another bad baseball game last night.
Well, it was better than the first one. We'll get there. But I actually want to tell how I found out about this, because it's not exactly as you describe. I was sitting in this chair doing some pod prep, and I went downstairs. I had the games on my TV downstairs, and I was ready to close up and go to bed. And I went down to just close everything off. And as I like turn around the corner, I think I went in the kitchen to like start the dishwasher and, you know, normal end of evening chores. So I walk past TV, nothing's happening. Like the Angels and Braves are on, there's nothing happening. I go into my kitchen to start the dishwasher. I come back, I pick up the remote to turn off the TV, and suddenly fists.
A fracas.
There was no buildup. And I think that is the key. I mean, I will explain to you how we got here. But in terms of the broadcast, I can't remember many where sometimes it's a bit delayed, where if there is something that happens on the mound and someone charges the mound, it's a little bit late. This was the most chaotic version of that. On both broadcasts, because of the play that had happened before, the beginning of this fight was not shown. Just suddenly, Reynaldo Lopez and Jorge Soler were swinging at each other next to the mound. And in that sense, it was very chaotic. So I was also like, oh my God, what? How did this happen? And it took a while to understand. So what did happen? Why did this happen? Or at least to the best of our understanding, Jorge Soler hit a home run against Reynaldo Lopez earlier in this game.
Very cool.
Which is fine, but it's important, because you might say, okay, well, did he like stand in the batter's box for 25 minutes and show him up? No, it didn't really seem like it. He seemed like a pretty standard jog around the bases. However, there is some history here, because Jorge Soler in his career has absolutely tortured Reynaldo Lopez for whatever reason. And after last night, this is adding a couple more times reaching base, because afterwards he was hit by a pitch and then had another pitch thrown at him. Jorge Soler against Reynaldo Lopez in his career hitting 609. In 26 plate appearances, a 2,045 OPS, 5 home runs in, as I mentioned, I think like 23 at bats, 3 doubles. After the first home run, it does seem that Reynaldo Lopez was not particularly having it anymore with Jorge Soler. He hits Soler in his second at-bat. Now, that was not like the first pitch. It was I think, the fifth pitch of the at-bat. He hits Soler up and in. And then in the third plate appearance, the first pitch of the at-bat is 97 to the backstop. Now, it wasn't directly over his head, but it was definitely up. What happened in that play, though, is that Nolan Schanuel advanced to second base. So when the ball goes to the backstop, Jonah Heim has to go retrieve it and then throws it down to second to try and, you know, get Nolan Schanuel. That's the play that is being shown on the broadcast. And Jorge Soler at that point is just like standing in the box waiting for the second pitch. But at some point during that, after the ball throws down, Heim throws the ball down to second, Soler and Lopez start chirping. It's not immediate, but after that first pitch of that third at bat that sails to the backstop, Soler's kind of giving him the death stare. And then it's still unclear who was the first person to really, they both start talking, and then Soler's like, let's do this. So he charges, Lopez charges, and now we have all of these images. The real highlight of this fracas we can get to, which involves Braves manager Walt Weiss. But with you watching this for the first time, what were your first takeaways now that I provided the history?
So the biggest takeaway is the squaring up, because guys don't often have enough time to like get the paws up and get into Floyd Mayweather position. And these guys have a little second here where they're like shuffling, you know, trying out for the contender on HBO. And that is the first visual that kind of got to me. The second one is just how clear everybody was trying to break this up that wasn't Lopez or Soler. And I think that is an important piece of context when we talk about this fight. There might not be two teams with more personnel overlap than the Angels and the Braves. Okay? The Angels general manager is Perry Manassian, who was in Atlanta for a very long time. Ron Washington was the manager last year. A lot of his staff was from Atlanta. I know that a lot of those guys are gone. Travis d'Arnaud is on the Angels. He was on the Braves forever. Jorge Soler, like, won the Braves a World Series. I don't know if you remember, in 2021, right? Like, these teams have a lot of overlap. And so it was kind of obvious when you watch the fight that no one else is interested in fighting. They just want these guys to knock it off.
Yes. And how could you forget Reynaldo Lopez's 13 games with the Angels in 2023? I mean, come on now.
How could I?
Very, very significant part of his career. But yes, this seemed to be a one-on-one situation. I just want to give some voice to the two participants here before we get back to the play-by-play of this fracas. Post-game, Jorge Soler was, of course, asked about it. He said, I asked him if – this is, of course, both through interpreters. I asked him if everything was okay, and the answer he gave me, I didn't like it. That's why I went out there. So I guess that's Soler saying that he said to Lopez, like, are we good, dude? Are you really throwing at my head right now because I keep hitting home runs against you? And whatever Lopez said back was not good. Soler continues, quote, obviously I have good numbers against him after the home run, getting hit by a pitch after that. And then he missed way too high and close to my head. At this level, you can't miss like that. This is what Reynaldo Lopez said through interpreter, friend of the show, Franco Garcia. Quote, it's just the shame, the situation and how things unfolded. On my part, there was never any intent to hit him at any point. So again, it's just a shame. That's kind of the quotes you would expect after a situation like this. But as you mentioned, that connection to the team, particularly with Soler and the Braves, brings us to the other most memorable moment of this. To me, it is a fight. It's a one-on-one. Like, a brawl to me implies multiple people are doing the fighting. And I don't think
it's the difference between it is the difference between a war and a battle. A war is a series of battles.
Sure.
A war is a series of battles. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A battle in and of itself is probably just a battle. There was no other frustration, it seems, no other intent to injure between any other two parties besides Soler and Lopez. And so for that reason, you are correct. Walt Weiss plays hero ball here. The skipper of the Atlanta Braves, who I believe is in his early 60s, who I think has like a history of like weightlifting and like he is, and he's like a thick dude. Okay. He is a thick man. He gets low here. Low man wins is the only thing I know about football. And he gets Soler in the knees. Perfect form tackle to get him on the ground and out of the brawl. This could not have gone better. No, Soler not hurt by this, like not physically injures him. He's not trying to hurt Soler. He's merely trying to defuse the situation with a tackle. Unbelievable performance by Walt Weiss. And let's be clear, for not that he didn't have cachet within his clubhouse. Like, you want to get your players to believe in you? I cannot imagine a quicker way to do that.
Yeah, and Walt Weiss is no stranger to these guys, including Jorge Soler, who said afterwards, when asked about being tackled by Walt Weiss, quote, "We have a good relationship. I don't think he tried to do anything against me. We're friends. I think he was just trying to protect me." And that's exactly correct. And that's the other point I kind of want to make about this. Like, I don't know these guys too well personally, but these are not players, either of them, with any sort of reputation for nastiness or on either side. Like, Jorge Soler, by all accounts, is one of the nicest people you're going to meet. Like, this is not someone with a history of you know, on-field aggression or anything like that. And so clearly that this, we just ended up with a very specific sequence of events and words said or not said or misinterpreted or whatever that led to this moment. And while I do think that after, you know, Mike Trout got hit, I did say after that, like, it would not surprise me if a team managed by Kurt Suzuki or Walt Weiss in this case, because I do think if we are ranking the managers by old schoolness, I know Kurt Suzuki just got the job and is a little bit younger, but if we are ranking the managers by likeliest to like get in a beanball war for reasons that are very stupid that we get on this podcast and be like, this is tired, this is uninteresting, these are probably two of the first ones you would pick. So I would not be surprised if this, maybe not Weiss.
I disagree about Walt. I disagree about Walt Weiss. I think that's unfair for Walt. I think he's a little, he is more old school presenting. And I think they're kind of the opposite in that way, where Suzuki is new school presenting, that is old school.
Yep. I don't know if he's presenting new school, but he is technically younger. So
young. Sure. He's young, old school. The last moment from this brawl that I would like to point out is Walt Weiss is the person that takes Soler out of the mix here. But in the few seconds afterwards, as the Angels kind of continue to try to defuse Lopez, do you see who the hero is that ends Lopez's frustration, that ends Lopez's fight?
Well, I mean, I are you talking about Mike Trout? I mean, I know he's one of the first ones there at the end. Yeah.
I am indeed talking about Mike Trout. Lopez, as the Angels are coming at him, is still like skittish and frisky. And then you see, this is in the MLB highlight package, like online, you see him still like hopping around like a boxer. And then he sees, he's like getting ready to throw another punch, and he sees that it's Mike Trout. And he just immediately like puts his hands down. It is an incredible thing. It's an incredible thing to watch. He's like, I'll punch anyone who comes at me. Oh, except for
not this Mike guy.
Not that guy.
Great point. I don't know if that's why Mike Trout thought like, I'm the perfect person to slow this down, because who's going to punch me? Either way, he does deserve credit. Sometimes you see the best, most famous players staying as far out of these situations as possible. And in this case, Mike Trout was like, no, I will get in there. The last thing I will just say about this quote, I think stands out to me again. This is from the story from Rhett Bullinger on MLB.com. let me also say that I am old enough to remember when MLB.com was not highlighting these moments in a way very prominently, where it was like when fights happen like this, it's like maybe we shouldn't be promoting this. Instead, you go on MLB.com this morning, and the first thing you see is fracas breaks out as tensions boil over between Soler and Lopez, and it's Soler just like getting ready to fight. Anyway, this quote from Suzuki stood out to me. This is in Red Story. Angels manager Kurt Suzuki said he believes the incident is behind both teams, understands why Soler did what he did. Soler said Lopez didn't have any control problems facing other hitters, hinting he believed Lopez did it on purpose. And yeah, Suzuki says, I don't blame Jorge one bit. You get thrown in your head, you have a family, a career, it's dangerous. I know it happens, but you ask any hitter and a ball gets thrown in your head, especially after hitting a homer, it's not good. So Kurt Suzuki is like, yep, it's fine. He needs to go charge at him. I support him, which is no surprise there. And and Walt Weiss also saying, I understand why Soler got angry. Like, yeah, it's fine. So this is probably like what
be coming.
Yeah. For both. I think Lopez, whether it was intentional or not, the fact that he hit him in the at bat before, the optics here are too bad to get away with. And however much chirping there, and the fact that Lopez even took a couple steps forward after, that's another thing that MLB usually will distinguish here. I think what was not great about this, but because it was so straightforward, normally when you have these messes, it'll delay the game like 10 minutes just because the umpires have to sort out like who's getting ejected and who did what. This was so simple. Vic Carapazza got on the mic and he said, the pitcher and batter are ejected for fighting. Let's resume. I was like, great. This is the easiest brawl ever. Like, I love this. So that was certainly appreciated in terms of its simplicity. But thankfully, nobody got hurt and we could sort of laugh about this. And I guess these teams are not going to play again this season. So this will have to back pocket for future. Yeah, but these guys are not playing today. I think that's pretty clear. I guess Soler probably will be in there if he's not injured. But Lopez versus Soler, I don't know when we're going to see that again. But it does not seem like this will linger over for the rest of this series. Okay, from the Angels in Anaheim to the Dodgers in Los Angeles. Just kidding, those Dodgers are in Toronto with Jake Mintz, who joins us from his hotel room to help us recap the first two games of the World Series rematch, and it is time for a field report.
Oh, you were excited about the World Series rematch? You thought that the energy of last October might carry in to early April? Well, sorry, because oof. Game one, Dodgers Blue Jays this week at the Rogers Center, had a lot of anticipation attached to it. When I walked into the yard, it was impossible to not think of World Series Game 7. I'm sure it was on the minds of most everybody in the building that was lucky enough to be there last autumn for one of the greatest baseball games that we will ever see. But while it was on the minds of everybody, it was certainly not in the bats and the arms and the gloves of the Toronto Blue Jays as the Dodgers walloped them into dust by the score of 14-2. Max Scherzer leaves after two innings with forearm tendonitis. Another Blue Jay down, maybe. In comes Josh Fleming, friend of the program who I played against in college, and things did not go well for Josh. We end up getting Miguel Rojas pitching in this game as like a real nail in the car, real twisting of the knife here. Afterwards, John Schneider was asked by someone in Toronto, like, do you think Dave Roberts, you know, put Rojas in there on purpose to kind of stick it to you guys? And Schneider was like, no, that's the guy that should be pitching. Like, that's like, Kike. He literally was like, Kike's not here. He was like, they do it with Kike. He's not here. So it had to be Rojas.
Right. It could have been Espinal, I guess, would have been the other answer. But yeah, not great.
And then game two was a little bit closer as Yoshinobu Yamamoto, the man who made that World Series possible, returned to the bump, returned to the scene of his crimes against the country of Canada. And he was brilliant for five innings. He was mediocre in the sixth, and he got chased in the seventh. He would have had a perfect game until the sixth if Kyle Tucker had not misplayed a ball early on. It was an incredible performance again from Yamamoto, who is going to give the Cy Young real run for its money. Blue Jays can't muster up any offense. John Schneider goes full tomato face, gets ejected. I don't think I've ever seen a person so scarlet as John Schneider last night. It was the biggest crowd pop that we had like all series long so far. The Dodgers take another one to win this series. Game three of this rematch will be tonight, or excuse me, this afternoon, as Shohei Ohtani will pitch in a baseball game, and I will be there to watch it. That is all important, Jordan. A lot of the Blue Jays are hurt. I think there's real cause for concern there. Addison Barger has injuries in both of his ankles. He's like a Stanton tennis elbow situation. Like, how are both your ankles hurt? All the Blue Jays' arms are on the IL. Mookie Betts is on the IL now. Whatever. I really would just like to talk about the brimless hat, though. I think we just have to talk about the brimless hat.
Listen, this is as ugly as it gets, but we cannot wait until Friday. And don't worry, we have plenty more ugly coming later on this week. So why don't you take us through one of your most viral tweets of all time, unintentionally, although I have to imagine you did have a feeling when you posted this photo that it was going to get a certain amount of reaction. However, 5,000 likes and 400 bookmarks and 600 retweets and allegedly 1 million views. Who knows what that means anymore on this broken website? But people responded to this photo that you posted of Edwin Diaz. So tell me, walk me through the seconds and minutes leading up to this photo taken of Edwin Diaz.
I'm standing outside the dugout next to Jack Harris of California Post. We're chatting it up. Edwin Diaz walks out to go like do his pregame stretch and like flat ground throwing. This is probably around 3:45-ish maybe. And as he walks by, Jack and I kind of look at him and we're like, looks weird there. And then we're watching him throw and Jack goes, that's not a beanie, is it? I was like, I don't think that's a beanie. I was like, well, we'll ask him when he comes back. So Eddie comes back and I'm like, hey, man, what's up with the hat? And he's like, what do you mean? I was like, the brim, there's no brim. Like you cut the brim off the hat.
I'm sorry. Pause right there. He was like, why are you asking me about my hat?
No, he wasn't like, why are you? I was like, the hat, he must have like maybe forgotten a little bit that like he had like had the brimless hat on. You know what I mean? Like, cause he was just, it was hat. His head was hat. And so he, you know, whatever. That's not the important part. The important, I was like, hey, the hat. He's like, oh yeah, Tanner Scott started this. We just cut the brims off. And Jack and I were like, okay. Can I take a picture? He's like, yeah, you know, Eddie, he's like the jolliest, happiest dude.
He's so nice.
I'm like, yeah. Can I take a picture? He's like, yeah. And so I tweeted it out. And then it became quite a thing. I learned last night that Major League Baseball may have phoned the Los Angeles Dodgers and told them no mas mm-hmm. cutting off the brims. And so I would like to file an apology to the Dodgers for accidentally narking on their harmless fun. And I don't think we'll be seeing a lot of brims anymore. Or I think we'll be seeing more brims.
Yeah, you will only be seeing brims. You certainly have nothing to apologize for. This was out in public. You did not take this photo in the clubhouse. I'm so fascinated by the timeline of when this became a thing. We just saw the Dodgers in D.C. and this was not
everyone
something
was brimmed
we noticed.
Up.
Everyone was brimmed up. As someone who wears these hats all the time, including on this podcast all the time, this is something, it's very personal thing to me, because again, this is not something I've ever considered at all. But as you mentioned, MLB might not want these Dodgers to wear hats that look like this. However, you cannot stop me. And that is why last night after this happened, with the help of my lovely wife and her seam ripper that she uses, the hat that I'm wearing right now, Pirates hat, brimmed up, full brim, right? However, yeah. I did decide to sacrifice one of my hats in the honor of Edwin Diaz. And if you're watching on YouTube, you're going to see me put it on now. Okay.
Oh my
God. So this is an Albuquerque Isotopes. Albuquerque Isotopes hat, former Dodgers AAA affiliate, now I believe the Rockies. But again, this was very carefully crafted by my wife. Shout out to Bailey. And as I'm wearing it, like, I just wanted to see what it felt like and what it looked like, right? And so what are your thoughts when you see this? Like, what do you – it's – she made a really good point, which is that it just looks like you're wearing a backwards hat, except it's not backwards. Like, if you had – it's just what a backwards hat looks like minus the brim. But it just feels like a hat, but I definitely would not be – would not be protecting me from the sun at all. And it kind of just feels like a big kippa. But what do you think?
Well, yeah, it's got Fez Koofy vibes.
Exactly. So anyway, do you think it looks good?
I don't think it looks good. I don't think it looks good. I think it looked better on Edwin Diaz.
Yeah, I agree with that.
This is the best MLB advertisement ever for people to watch the show on YouTube. If you're listening on podcast players, you just... go over to YouTube.
But this is my point. If you have a backwards hat on, normally you have the MLB logo or the MILB logo. And it's like, oh, whatever. This is what every episode of Foul Territory looks like. It's just this.
Yep.
Right? Nothing notable about that. Yep. But man, when you have the logo on the front and no brim, you're like, what is going on there? What is happening? So anyway, I will not be sacrificing any more hats for this purpose, whether MLB is just telling me that or not. But I still would like some more journalism done about this. I still think that you should go talk to Tanner Scott and find out what prompted this, why they thought this would look good. Does it make them more comfortable? I do understand that they're inside in Toronto, so it's like, we don't need to protect from the sun, so that's not a problem. Like, we just want to wear a hat. So I still have more questions, is my main point.
I'm going to let Jack do it as someone who covers the Dodgers. I'm going to let him, shoulder that load. I did send Jack, the California Post, probably best known for its headlines. I sent him the headline on the league, kind of telling them that not to do this anymore. Brim possible. MLB flips lid on Dodgers hat trick. Hire me.
That's a Mint's original, folks. It's just
feel
to be
good
clear,
about that.
That is a straight Mint's gem.
AI cannot replace me, at least not yet. Speaking of someone that cannot be replaced by AI, let's welcome on Dalton Rushing, catcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers. You can't replace Dalton with AI. AI Claude is 0-0.
No, I'm just wondering Dalton's takes on these hats, and I guess we can go ask him. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are now excited to welcome in a longtime friend of the program. It's Dodgers catcher Dalton Rushing. Dalton, welcome to the podcast, my friend.
What's up, guys? I'm glad to be here.
So before we do anything else, I want to give you a West Tennessee born and raised boy a chance to respond to the vicious attacks on the city of Memphis by LeBron James. What are your thoughts? What is your response?
Honestly, I haven't looked too much into it. Crazy enough, my fiance last night was at the Lakers game and made it pretty known he was soft for not playing again. but no, I haven't looked too deep into it. I don't think the Grizzlies are doing too great to care.
Tough spot for you as an LA sports figure and Memphian.
Which side do I take, though? I don't get into the basketball beef. I feel like there's plenty of it to go around every single day. We have enough of our problems to worry about,
Can you dunk?
I used to actually be able to. I don't think anymore. 225 pounds. That's a lot of weight to get up. But, no, I was a little smaller. I had a little more bounce. Sophomore, junior year, and I could get up there. But honestly, I don't even know if I want to try it. Maybe in a couple of years, just to convince myself that I'm still young, you know? But no, at one point, yes, but probably not anymore.
I don't know when your dunking days concluded specifically, but what has been very clear for you, Dalton, is that hitting has been your focus. And while it might seem like, I know the other night you hit two homers against the Blue Jays and everyone wants to talk to Dalton Rushing, we've been talking to you about hitting for a while. And we know that this is something that you've been passionate about for quite some time. And the unique circumstances of your path to the big leagues has landed you, at least for now, in more of a part-time role where we don't get to see that on display as often. But let's go back earlier for you, because when do you start to realize, like, okay, hitting is my thing. Yes, I can catch too. That's something I'm passionate about, and that's an important position. But I know the way that you've thought about hitting for a long time, dating back to your days in college, and how seriously you take it, and the ability to put that on display with a four-hit game the other night, I know was I'm sure very satisfying. But let's go back to the beginning. Like, when do you start to have that knack? Like, all right, I can put the bat in the ball, and I can put a charge into one.
Yeah, I think it kind of comes when I get to the point where I'm kind of trying to play the game a little bit with the pitcher, and I'm understanding like their moves before they understand what they're trying to do. I think that's when I really like understood the art of hitting, and hitting's not just having a great swing. Yeah. There's guys in this game that go up there and they master their swing to cover X, Y, and Z, but they're exposed to this and that. But I think like understanding the art of hitting and being able to pick a pitcher apart before he beats you, I think that's, you get so much satisfaction as a baseball player from it. And, there's really no better feeling. So to answer your question, I'd say around like, probably like as a teenager, it's like, I'm 13, 14, 15 years old playing up against some older kids. And, it's like, obviously these kids aren't a quarter of as polished as college pitchers, professional big league pitchers. But the more I'm understanding how these guys that are 3-4 years older than me are thinking, then it's like, all right, we're getting on the same brain level, wavelength. I'm understanding what you're trying to do. And when, like I said, you're 4 years older than me. I enjoy playing the game though. It's like being able to pick a pitcher apart. And as a catcher, you know, it helps a lot, I would say. But that's to me the definition of being a hitter.
Also curious, when you mention that passion for picking a pitcher apart, but you talk about those early matchups when you're maybe 13 playing against 15 and 16 year olds or so on and so forth, or even a freshman in college, right? And you're facing against more experienced college arms. The information that you have on these opponents has only gone up and up and up and up as you've gotten older, but also, of course, they've just become better and better and better. What does that look like when you are younger? Like, what, when you are in college, like, how do you feel that? How did you gain that edge when in Tennessee high school baseball, you didn't have extremely elaborate scouting reports?
Yeah.
So what does that look like then? And then what does that look like now?
I mean, you know what the guy throws. That's really it when you're at that level. And to me, I think I've always taken pride in my plate discipline. So before I take an at bat against, let's say I'm facing a lefty that throws, when I'm a junior in high school, he's throwing 88. Well, one, I need to know what he's throwing. What kind of pitches does he throw? And then I just play in my head, like, what's the shape? Like, where do I need to hunt this pitch in order to, one, not chase, but two, also give myself a chance to do damage. And, that's kind of similar to what I do now. It's obviously, like you said, we know what color socks each guy is wearing every day and if they wear their socks up or they wear their socks down. But it's really just, I try and match up a plan to give myself the best chance to do two things. Don't swing at pitches out of the zone and don't miss pitches in the heart of the plate. That's my whole game plan. And, there's so many pitchers in today's game that you're going to get up there and you may not get a pitch to hit in three at bats. You may just honestly out of three at bats hope that you flick two to the outfield and maybe a sac fly, maybe roll over one and get a run in from third. Like there's days like that. There's days you have to take those wins. But like I said, if I don't develop a little plan of trying to put myself in the best position to not miss the mistake, then you're already behind the eight ball, especially now.
Something that I've found to be super interesting and impressive, just like getting to be around the game at the big league level now, is the mental compartmentalization that you have to have. And you hear this all the time of like not bringing your bad at bat or your bad result with you into the field. And that is even way more important for a catcher. And so what I'm interested for you specifically, for someone that does care about hitting and like thinks about their bat at bats from such an analytical perspective and cares so deeply, how do you leave that behind? Let's say you fly out to end an inning, you got to strap the gear on and be ready to catch 98 in a minute and a half. So it's like, What is your process of leaving that baggage behind in such a short span of time?
Yeah. I mean, this has been hard for me at times. It's part of, especially getting to this level with the staff. I think you get a little more exposed than maybe I would if I was with a lot of other teams. Just the little things get noticed, you know. If I'm not
the standard,
locked in,
the standard for you guys is on a different level.
It's not even close.
That's
and
a
people.
Fact.
I don't think people from the outside looking in really even comprehend the difference. I strike out on four pitches three games into my big league career, and I have to turn around and go catch the greatest left-handed pitcher of all time. And if I miss one pitch call, I might be going back to Oklahoma City. And that's pressure. pressure. And that's having to understand really what I guess being a catcher and being a guy like Dot's catcher, you start to understand that the game is so much bigger when you're in the squat than when you're standing in a box, especially for a team like this. I mean, we're rolling out Cy Young after Cy Young, MVP after MVP, the greatest player to ever play the game today. Gonna be a blast to watch that happen. I've started to develop some sort of routine of saying, look, like, all right, however you just got me out, all I'm going to do, I'm going to put my stuff down. You're not doing it again. And if you do, you're not doing it a third time. You know what I mean? It's more of like prepare for the next one rather than dwell on the last one. And that's right. Kind of the headliner of how I try and carry it with these guys, because that kind of, it lights a little fire under me to get the competitive juices flowing and say, all right, well, look, you're going to strike me out. I'm going to go strike out the side with this pitcher, you know, like one of those things. It's just like keep the competitive juices
flowing. People always
flowing.
Say in baseball, like one of the great things is you get to do it the next day. When you're a catcher,
correct,
you get to do it the next half inning. You're contributing no matter what. Right.
Correct.
And I imagine that makes that process in a way a little bit easier.
100%. The stress levels up because you're like, you have 13 things going through your head. You're worried about what this hitter, this hitter, and this hitter is going to do. As well as, all right, if I'm up in the seventh with runners on second and third, two outs, and I'm facing their top-notch closer, what pitch am I going to be on? You know, there's so many things to worry about in baseball. And luckily last year was a huge testament to me learning and understanding what it means to be a big league catcher. And like I said earlier, not just a big league catcher, be a catcher with the Dodgers, with a team like this. You're bought into whoever's on the mound. You're bought into whoever comes out of that bullpen. You're doing everything in your power to make sure every single pitch is perfectly executed for each one of these guys. Because in their eyes, they can perfectly execute every single pitch that they want. And just going back, the standard's higher, man. It shows day in, day out. It just puts a lot more on your plate. But if you have the competitive level that most of us have, not all of us have, then you're totally fine with it.
Last thing I want to ask you about is, this is kind of related to Will Smith.
Advanced.
And like, what I've kind of gathered from watching him work is that he moves with this confidence and this borderline arrogance and the self-assuredness in himself, where I think, and you can talk about this because you've been around him way more than we have, it's like he doesn't dwell on his at-bats because he believes to his core that the next time he's up, he's going to get a hit. He's going to have a good at-bat. And so it's almost not even like he's worried about it. Not that he doesn't care. That's not what I'm saying, right? Like, but he's like, I'm so damn good that I will solve that next problem in the box. And so I don't need to think about it when I'm in the squat. Is that kind of what you've seen from being around him? How is he able to kind of separate those two things?
It's the more I've gotten to know him, and I won't speak too much for him, but
yeah,
the more I've gotten to know him, I really understand that. I mean, people call him a silent assassin. He is like, he in his brain is thinking about how he's going to beat you without showing you a lick of emotion. And I always think of it too, like it's like when you golf with this guy. I don't know if you've ever heard a story about golfing with Will Smith, but if you want to actually enjoy your round, don't go golf with Will Smith, because he's going to embarrass you and he's going to make you feel like you've never picked up a golf club before. But he's just like this the whole time. And as much as I wish I could do that on a baseball field, it's impossible. I don't even want to try it. But going back to him and the way his process works, it's the confidence level is through the roof. I wouldn't say he shows the arrogant side. I mean, I don't think many people could just walk up to Will Smith and be like, hey, dude, you're arrogant. Like, he gave you no reason to say that, you know? Outwardly.
He gave me a great quote. I was talking to him the other day and he was like, there's a difference between arrogance and confidence. And he
100%.
And he takes pride in, and I asked him, I was like, what's the difference? He's like, well, it's how you carry yourself the rest of the time. Right. And like, I could imagine how, if I was a vet and like Will Smith, the rookie, showed up on my team and like believed in himself to that extent, that I would be like, who's this guy think he is? Oh, he thinks he's Will Smith. Like, he thinks he's a borderline.
Yeah. It happened in 2019.
Right. Right. Exactly.
I agree. I say it's confidence over arrogance. There's that guy's, he would do anything for anyone. He would do anything for anyone that he cares about as much as the guys that are in the clubhouse with him. It's one, a blessing to be with a guy like that, a guy that came through a similar path, similar situation. Maybe not as exaggerated, but as I play the game, as I'm watching the games, there's always like moments of teaching the game a little bit.
Yeah.
And he does such a good job of translation for it. And I mean, he'll even credit himself to understanding early in his career, he didn't have someone like this. It was like he ran through the Russell Martin, and then it was kind of like a headbutt of like back and forth playing time to who's going to start this day, who's going to start that day, you know? And, but no, he's great. I would never put arrogant in the same word or in the same sentence with Will, but, it's the confidence is through the roof, as it should be, you know? He's given himself every right to feel that way.
And my last question for you before we let you go is just kind of reflecting on this journey for you, because we've talked to you about, you know, we interviewed you at the Futures game, and when you got drafted by the Dodgers, understanding that that was a really good spot for you, understanding what the Dodgers are great at, that they were already this great organization. When you're drafted in 22, they had won in 2020, they'd won all these games, they were this big thing. But since then, they have elevated to a whole other level, right? Now with these back-to-back World Series, which you've been a part of, when you think about when you felt it was... Wait, yeah, there's a lot. When you think about how you felt when you first became a Dodger to now being a real part of this team, especially as someone who like knows ball, loves ball, is thinking about this stuff all the time, and now has the opportunity. Ohtani wasn't on the Dodgers when they drafted, you know, you, right? So now that you're living this, have you thought about like, oh, wow, like, okay, this is maybe not, it's even more than what you expected. How like often, you're a part you of still history. Have, of course, a lot.
you know?
Yeah. And you still have much more on a personal level. I know you have so many higher goals and aspire to get to and at totally understood. Yeah. But even from where you're at now, just these last 4 years, what do you kind of think
about
this?
I don't really know how I felt when I got drafted, because it was like, I didn't really care who drafted me. I was at that point. It's like, you draft me, like, I am the luckiest player that got picked in that draft because it was the Dodgers. But I was, at first it was like, all right, Los Angeles, like my goal was never to look into the minor league affiliates. It was like, that's not my goal here. I'm going to play in LA, and I'm going to play in LA for a long time. And, that I had mixed feelings, because I was like, all right, I'm not a West Coast kid. I'm from a small town in Tennessee. So, it was a little different, but getting here and understanding how much, even outside of the clubhouse and what goes on behind the scenes, like understanding how much the city cares about winning, there's nothing like it. And then you go into the organization as a whole. It's the best organization in baseball. To your point, they say, all right, we're going to build a dynasty. We're going to do it. And I get to be a part of it regardless of what the role is. The role can change in the snap of fingers. But it is.
You get to be around greatness. You get to be around greatness every day.
We're going to be the same team for as long as this sport, as long as Robert
Manfred. As long as this sport allows you to do this.
As long as baseball allows us to be this team, we're going to be this team.
Yeah.
And it's a blessing. I don't want to be anywhere else. I want to win as many games as possible. That's my whole goal when I play this game. And I think we're going to do plenty of that over the next 8 to 10 years.
Yeah, I'll take the over. Dalton Rushing, thank you for joining us. Appreciate you. Congratulations on a hot start to the year. I'm not sure how long that OPS is going to start with a 2, but may it end the season with a 1.
Hey, I'll enjoy it as long as I can.
We know you will. Thank you, Dalton. We'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Thanks, guys. You're the best.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Brimless hats and punches thrown. Those were not the only pieces of drama from Wednesday night. Something else we got to talk about. Jordan, we're almost done with this podcast. How would you feel if right at the end I made you leave?
I wouldn't be thrilled, especially because you know what? I usually finish the podcast. In fact, I finish more podcasts than most other podcasters. And that is likely how Sandy Alcantara felt on Tuesday night when Clayton McCullough, the Marlins manager, came out with 1 out in the 9th inning with Sandy having thrown 95 pitches. There were a couple runners on, and the Marlins had just a 2-0 lead. However, Sandy Alcantara, who has thrown more complete games in baseball than anyone else since he became like a major league starting pitcher really in 2019, did not have that opportunity, as they instead went to Anthony Bender, who promptly came in and he pitched really poorly. And that game went to extra innings, and the Reds ended up winning. So Sandy does not get his complete game, and the Marlins lose in extras to Cincinnati. Afterwards, of course, you go to Sandy Alcantara, like, hey, I bet you didn't want to come out of that game, huh? And he's like, no, not really. The exact quote coming from Sandy, I feel like I deserve to be asked how I feel before getting taken out of the game at 95 pitches and a righty on deck, but I respect the decision. I think that when you read some of the quotes, it sounds like Sandy is, and he said, like, when you read the quotes, you're like, oh man, Sandy was in there. He was hot. He was pissed. And then you watch the video and like, Sandy's like ridiculously nice. And he's just like, yeah, like it was disappointing. You know, I was mad at myself about how the inning started. And I hope that I, you know, next time can do better. So this isn't necessarily some huge amount of friction, but I do think this specific example of a pitcher getting taken out because of his history, because of just the Marlins of it all, what has changed since Sandy was the ace of the Marlins who was being allowed to go through complete games because Don Mattingly certainly wasn't taking him out of games.
Yes.
I think that is kind of the interesting part of this.
I think that if this happened in July, Sandy would have more ground to stand on. Sandy Alcantara has looked good to start this season, really good, and that is very encouraging. Sandy Alcantara is trying to get back to what he was. Like, he has not been himself for 3 years now. And while he's looked pretty great, I understand McCullough being like, hey, man, you're not Sandy Alcantara right now, right? We need you to continue to be this version of yourself that you've looked like, yes. But I don't know if Sandy, like, he's not at the top of his game, is I guess what I'm saying. And so I understand why McCullough probably like wants to yank him. I think from a managerial perspective, it's the right decision if you're trying to win the baseball game. Like, yes, Bender coughed it up, but like he's probably Sandy's probably done, you know? And the way I really feel is the Marlins of it all is like, just let the guy finish the game. Like, whatever. You're going to win 77 games. Like, just let Sandy finish it. But it's also April 7th, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's just the contrast. And Sandy literally threw a complete game in his last outing against the White Sox. He was great against the Rockies to start the season. And he had yet to allow an earned run until these runs ended up being scored after he left the game here this season. So definitely disappointing. And it is just such a far cry from earlier in his career in 22 and 23. He had six complete games in 2022. And his complete game, and people were posting this clip because as like a contrast, July or end of June 2022, this was one of my favorite regular season games, just efforts I can remember. I know random Marlins Cardinals. I just remember it so well because he had gone eight. The Marlins were losing. They hit a go-ahead home run in St. Louis at the top of the ninth. He comes back out to close it out. Two runners get on. Mattingly comes out. He's at 117 pitches. And he's like, this is my game. Let me finish this. He gets the double play, and it was like, yes, that is Sandy Alcantara. He's one of the best pitchers in baseball. We know he wins the Cy Young the next season. And now it's just like, nope, sorry, got to go to the reliever because he's better than that. So it's disappointing. I understand it for everybody involved there. And I will just say, remember, my bold prediction, Sandy Alcantara traded in April. He's pitching well enough, and we'll see where the Marlins are at in the standings, but I'm keeping an eye on that one. Again, I'm trying to get on the board after you got Stan to steal a base. And I think this one is still in play. So we'll see what happens. Sandy is throwing quite well. All right, a couple other quick things before we say goodbye. Let's go around the league.
Connor Griffin can hoist 140 million cones if you'd like, because he is richer today than he was yesterday as the Pirates Wunderkind signed an extension with the Buccos, 9 years, $140 million. Escalators, elevators, stairwells can take him to $150 million. There's a $12 million signing bonus. This will go through 2034. He can still hit free agency entering his age 29 season. This was coming. Pirates GM Ben Cherington talked about it yesterday and like played hilariously dumb. But he's like, yes, I certainly hope that this is something that maybe could happen one day if we, in a world that might exist in a timeline that could be ours. Who's to say? What even is baseball? Okay, bye. And then, you know, 12 hours later, Connor Griffin hanging around. Good job. Good job, Pittsburgh Pirates, is a sentence that just came out of my mouth. Because you gotta hop in early. If you don't hop in early, you'll miss the boat. As they did with Paul Skeens. Like, they missed the Skeens boat. He got priced out of what they were willing to spend, what they are willing to spend. And they ensured that within their, you know, restrictions that they've set for themselves, they were able to keep Connor Griffin around.
Yeah, and regardless of the specifics, I think that's a pretty standard trend we've seen across the game is teams are willing to commit to hitters. And I think we've already talked about a few of them recently with Cole Emerson. We've seen it with Jackson Churio. We've seen it with, I mean, of course, with Bobby Witt and Julio and so on.
pitchers, for as special as Paul Skenes is, and now, as you mentioned, I think we're just past the point where that is a reasonable expectation for him to be signed to an extension. I certainly don't expect that. That doesn't mean I expect them to trade Paul Skenes anytime soon, and I hope that that's not the case. And as the Pirates hopefully move closer towards contention, that is not something we are discussing at any point. But to get some offensive building blocks in place, which, as we have said time and again, has been sorely lacking in Pittsburgh for years and years and years during this postseason drought. And of course, since they produced Andrew McCutchen, this is the guy. So again, if you want more just Connor Griffin background, I think our conversation about him when he got called up covers a lot of that. So you can go back to that episode and check that out. But he's here now, and he's the Pirate shortstop. And we now get to enjoy that for several more seasons, and the Pirates fans don't have to hear about, Connor Griffin's getting traded to the Yankees. Like, they don't have to worry about that. They can just be like, okay, he's here. Still got a lot else to figure out. Still got a lot else to prove. But Connor Griffin is a Pittsburgh Pirate, and that is something that Pirates fans can hold on to, get excited about as his career progresses. I'm excited for him, and it makes sense, I think, for him, even foregoing some free agency years. And I mean, hey, $140 million, 20, he's still 19, right? He turns 20 in a couple of weeks. It's a heck of a start to your career, and I look forward to watching him in Pittsburgh. I'm glad, as someone who lives 2 hours away, I'm glad I also get to know that Connor Griffin's going to be there, and that is also exciting.
Yep.
All right. One other bit of news before we say goodbye, and this is not the fun kind. We have two major arm injuries that we got some clarification on earlier this week, and that is Hunter Brown of the Houston Astros with a grade 2 shoulder strain, and Cade Horton with the Cubs, who needs a second elbow surgery after having it earlier in his career in college. This just sucks. These are two pitchers that were so important to their teams coming into the season. Brown, who had established himself as one of the best right-handed pitchers in baseball. Cade Horton, who had this tremendous rookie season. Brown, his importance all the more after Fromber leaves. It's like, okay, well, at least we got Hunter Brown. We can figure out the rest after him. Now he's gone for at least a while, as they say he will, quote, refrain from throwing for a few weeks, which is maybe one of the most vague injury updates I've ever heard or seen. One of the strangest phrasings of an injury update I've seen. But he's not going to be back for, I would guess, at least a month, maybe longer. And then Cade Horton seemingly out for the year, which is a devastating blow for him, having gone through elbow surgery before at the start of his major league career. Now, trying to get that off the ground. We felt like that those injury concerns, durability concerns were behind him, but now not so much. So we will see how those guys fill, how they backfill those innings. I think that is something that these teams are in different positions to do. But for teams that expect to be in the postseason, these are pretty important injuries that will impact their pitching plans for the beginning of the season. If you want to read more about these injuries and get in the good, yeah, go ahead.
Someone call Lucas Giolito, please. That's it. Thank you.
Come on. Sign our pal.
What are we doing?
Thank you to Dalton Rushing for joining us. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Arosas for producing this episode of Baseball Barbacast. And thank you to Edwin Diaz for wearing a hat with no brim for some reason. We will be back on Friday. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. See you.